And I've always felt, right since that time that you first went into the Waimakariri region, that your treatment of the landscape is the forms are psychic forms, and this is perhaps the area of major differentiation, perhaps with McCann, who was, of course, also going into that landscape at roughly the same time and before.
He was going through in a literal sense as well.
McCann paints a landscape where the detail of psyche isn't so much there as the big masses, whereas you're intricately characterising the world as you move along.
I don't think it's a characterising.
Well, not characterising in the normal sense of the word, of making, you know, of defining.
Demonising.
but you're making it into psyche.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, you give form to feelings. Yeah. And if those forms come about because you feel strongly, and they're not just concocted for an abstract reason or for some literal reason, then they're close to what the actual thing is. I think the figure, the human figure, is an enactment or an aspect of energy. And that how you use it depends how you're defining the energy. If you do it collectively to the singular, so you're doing everything. If you do a collective thing, it's all a thing. It's interconnecting. You get the musicality, you get your stage, then you get your other thing to enter the stage, which is needed anyway for the other to be seen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you've got a vortex which needs space. Vortexes need time. Time needs space.
That's right.
And so you come forward, and then you. It's like me when I painted the theatre works, which are very important actually, and I've never been seen early where I've got. And that was the audience. I always created the world coming to the audience, and the audience waiting for it. Waiting for the unknown. What's going to appear through the vortex, with the vortex, you know. Yeah.
We're in this general period, or rather at the end of it. You and Coral returned to England, and you went to, was it the Royal Academy? And did that sort of reinforce that sense of the figurative theatre of the world by going back into
the Royal Academy just set me up for me to see how I stood against it, or stood with what was around me at the time, or with history of art, you know, generally speaking. And when I was there, I realised that I could draw. Greenham, who was in charge there, thought I was a revolutionary, personally, as a personality, you know, in a sense, because I remember that I was still a bit touchy about my background and that the way the class structure worked, which still irritated me, you know. And you could still feel it in the air, you know.
Well, particularly in London, I guess.
Oh, that's right. And the privilege with him. He painted the Queen, Greenham, and he said that I was quite good, he said, but I think you'll be better off in another country. Hello there, hi. And I used to say, well, I remember I wrote a poem at that time, no red brick university for this lot, future accommodation, concrete blocks. I remember that's the stance, all I can remember it, but that I knew they were building the red brick universities. They were building all the things which were going to, which at the end, destroyed a lot of things, because I think the red brick universities only taught them how to commercialise themselves or, you know, become technical or be like everybody else. I don't think they ever taught that freedom. I think that's the difference between, you know, when you look at pre-democracy, if you want to, that basically they attended the talented and the people who had an aesthetic to a degree which was seen as of a nature to be cultivated, and with democracy, it melted down that any individual who gets up to the point where they're any bloody good has to be melted down so that all the rest could have it.
Do you feel melted down?
Well, I'm not saying that. It's only my observation. I'm not melted down. But in looking at it, you're thinking, well, where does the wonderment since the Second World War of everything, you know, from your Beatles and from everybody going, coming through, all singing song, whoa, whoa, yay, yay, yay. But there's no advancement. There's no sense of going any further than with the air. It can be, it explains the time, but it doesn't explain future time. And so basically it's not doing its job. Any culture must create the future.
Problem of carrying, of continuing on what is broadly called a classical tradition, I think it is very difficult in this time. And one of the factors that I think has made it very difficult is the speed with which technology is forever transfiguring everything. And people are having no time to draw breath and evaluate. And that's as big a factor as any other single factor.
We know that's a factor. That's why it's been said. Otherwise, you wouldn't have to say it. Basically, it's turned to that. So that's the truism. Right? Yeah, that's a fact. But it doesn't mean to say that it had to be. Yeah. We made a choice.
Yeah. We made a choice to go that
that's
way.
Right. Well, yeah,
but in doing so, in a way, we've imperiled our inner processes, I think. Because we have this endless cycle of novelty and change, and it's very difficult to establish abiding
values. That's true, but
there's
another thing. Human beings love to be... One of the things about society, why society exists, is for people to hide in. That's what it means, social, togetherness, get lost, look after me if it's bad, so-and-so and so-and-so. You know, that's what it is. So... All they're doing is searching for insurance for existence, but they don't realize that they create existence. The height you get is because we create it. If we don't reach the heights, then we're part of the aspect of the earth dying, or it doesn't want us. And that's what you do. That's when you vegetate, as you say.
So you think your best insurance policy is to paint as well as you can?
Well, we're talking in the past tense a little bit now on what I've done. But I do believe why I did it, what I've said is why I did it. Whether I'll go on to that, I've got macro degeneration. I don't know whether I'll last, you know. So I might be gone in a few months, I might go like in a flat. I don't know. There's all that. Of me to rush off to say that I'm here, I didn't do it for that. I did it for the joy of doing it, wanting to do it, or the pain of doing sometimes. Pain, I mean, self-portraits are one of the bloody things of pain, or if not, you're having a look at yourself. In vain, or you know, a bit of vanity to it. But at the same time, one of the reasons for self-portraits is to tell the truth to yourself as much as you can. Otherwise, you don't go on. You start searching amongst others for who you are, and that's what's happened with civilization. If you look at the paper every day in Australia, say, in the Australian things like that, you know, we're all looking for what somebody said. You don't need to look for what other people say, unless it comes up in a way which is beneficial and to a degree innocent too. I don't know if you put it in words. But everybody, I mean, you put on the 1,000 died today, so-and-so blew up a church in Baghdad, another 1,000, somebody shot themselves, got the alcohol right, so down the road. It's estimates all that. It's always statistical death in everything what they're doing. There's nothing means anything. If the arts come because the school did it or so-and-so or a community did it for so-and-so and they're doing it and they're going to put it on and then the next week it'll be so-and-so and so-and-so. There's nothing stops for a minute for it to actually have a larger definition. I don't think it's made for it anymore. All your techniques and everything like that are towards not going any further because you go outside of the spectrum, what do you call it, though, you know. The picture, yeah.
Now, in this period of the...
Did I explain it?
Yeah. The 60s, you had already embarked on your very long series of self-portraits by then, hadn't you?
Yeah.
You were already starting to do self-portraits as well as portraits in general.
It's the pain of being, Dennis. Mm. There is a pain in being sometimes. Mm. There's a joy, but it's not as often as pain in being.
Yeah. And I often meant to ask you why, when you left England, Coral and the kids came back by public transport, so to speak, and you chose more or less to walk back from Belgium to Malaysia. So, yeah.
Well,
I wondered what your reason for that was.
We'd been in lodgings, and the lodgings, were terrible actually in some ways, but we'd been in one place. I won't mention the name of a chap I knew here. It's actually in the book. And he stayed, or they stayed, this wife stayed with me in Wimbledon, and with Cuddle and kids and that. And we put them up. And the landlord, we couldn't afford the rent very much, so I think I got out a week in front to pay the rent, to pay the other one. I didn't have the money. And he took us to court and said that I'd also plugged the wire into the electricity and got free electricity. I never did. Never. I know where the points were as well, but I never did. So when he took us to court to come up, and the judge looked, and I went to a lawyer, and he said, oh, you can look after yourself. You know, but in other words, I couldn't afford to pay for him, that's all. So I looked after myself, and I was finished. As soon as I got up on that stage, you know, and I didn't keep the protocol up, you know, of the court, you know, it was a bit difficult for me. But he said, do you think, Mr. Pearson, this is the chap who's staying with us, did the, you know, put the points on the electricity there, you know? And he said, would you say he did or didn't? And he said, would or wouldn't, I can't remember. And I think he said like something, I don't know. He didn't say, no, you didn't. And I didn't. But he doubted me. And do you know what? And it was because he was more like them than he was like me, the person who was staying with me. He was more sort of caught with the system, caught with the type, the herringbone bloody jacket, than he was really with the friendship he had with me. And so basically, he put me in. And that's why I got out, because they charged me 100-odd quid or something like that, and I didn't have it. And I had a little bit like that, and they'd gone on the boat. And I went to Ostend, put a big piece of plastic over me, and got a lorry and got to Aachen and shot south to Cologne and down south and sang for my suppers with German youth. the Jugend. And went right down to Munich and there was a holiday, the chap with the big tents and all that, you know, and he had little blonde-haired kids and all that, you know, he was a real German. And and England had just won the World Cup, 1966, you know, and they went in there. And I couldn't speak, he put us up. And he said, they're all, what was it? Don't go south of the Alps, he said, they're all pygmies, everybody. And that was and I always remember saying that, you know, that. He said, where are you going? And I said, India, you see. He went, phew, like that, you know. I thought, is that interesting?
Well, this is a journey.
Does it sound racist or anything?
This is a journey you couldn't make now, of course.
Yeah. What?
You couldn't make this journey now.
Oh, no.
Because...
No, but it was just meeting up with these characters. Now they just come up, you know, against you. But it's all, as you say, it's sort of, it makes you as a person, you know, in the long run. But out of there, I just went on to Yugoslavia, and then through Yugoslavia through to Greece, and then on to Constantinople, Ankara, and then across the plains of Iran. And I was ill. I slept in little mud huts on the roads in Iran, just outside of Tehran. And then I was picked up by a general's wife, me and another hitchhiker, two hitchhikers, and she put us up. And it was a big compound. They had walls, you know, and inside was the apartments and that. And I went out and got drunk, and they don't get drunk in Muslim countries. Purely, I went to a dance, and I'd never drank anything for a while, and I just freed up, and I was dancing with the Danish air hostess there, and I got back. They must have been rotten, and I laid out in the thing, and I was smoking in those days, and I lit the bed, the mattress. And so the whole thing burned out because I came down it like that. When it was burning and it was getting close to my head, I shifted down and fell off the end. And then they went crazy because to them that was a materialistic thing, but to smoke, you know, was like a great sin. You know, I had to get out the next day. Went up into the Atlas Mountains there, right up to Caspian Sea, and out to about 800 miles to Mashhad in eastern Syria, and that's the holy city of Mashhad, which is the big Muslim center there. And then across there, the border into Herat in Afghanistan, and then onto Kandahar. And there's a lot of ventures in between there. I can't go through it in the interview, but I'll just give you a pattern of it. And then I managed to get out, and in Kabul I was very, very sick, very, very, very sick. I always wondered about that world there, because the Turkmen and everything like that, people on the streets with eye, you know, what's that disease for the eyes when you turn up and you can't see the pupil? Anyway, there's a lot of people with those, you know, type of eye disease and stuff, and so different, but the lack of hygiene gets me. It got me right through India too. I found that pretty difficult. And, you know, wasn't appropriate for my living circumstances, which was generally on the floor of a desert, you know, before that. But, I was pretty sick, and I had bacillary dysentery. And I got what money I had. I bought, there's a national United Nations hospital in Kabul, and they gave me pills. And then I hitchhiked, went down through the Khyber Pass and come out of in Pakistan and come down to Lahore, and they just had the war there with the Indians, you know, on the border there, 1966. I crossed over there at Husainiwala and south to Delhi, and then right down to Nagpur, right across Agra, or Delhi, Agra, and then Nagpur, Madras. And I came out, which I saw a few of the temples and all that, so I was interested in those things and that, but I was very ill most of the time. And I got the city of Madras. I waited on the beach with a towel around my head while everybody just picked and looked at me and said, "Take me with you." Half the country was wanting to go with me. I couldn't even stand up. I thought, they can use anything. Anyway, went across there, and I remember just make a little note in the sea. What was it? A Bengal tiger jumped out of the sea and in one bite swallowed me. I always remember saying that. Because there's somebody I'd got a lift with who was actually obnoxious. And it was the feeling was, you know, nothing could be worse than that. But anyway, I got along to Penang and went south on a grain trucks with a big Chinese straw hat. You know, those big wide things around. I was pretty there. And they were saying to me, "Oh, you're very ill." Everybody was saying to me, "You're a very ill person." And I got down to Johor Bahru and I stayed eating egg cakes in Singapore, and I didn't have any money left, and I had to borrow money off the embassy for a passport, you know, to get my fare back, and I had to pay it when I got back.
Right.
And when I arrived at Auckland Airport, in Singapore, they thought I was a drugger or something like that because my hair was so long. Never took drugs in my life. That was one thing I never did, either in New Zealand, during the, you know, at any time. Anyway, it was when I got there, and the two kids were waiting for me at the airport, Carla looked at me and went, "I was 7 stone. See? And so they had to put me to bed and nurture me up again.
Now, I've got a portrait of you made just after that journey, and you look very haggard.
Yeah, very haggard. I went into the sheds and worked there, and then I got the designers. I became a designer for TV2. So I did Come On and all those things, you know. So and that was very interesting, especially because in those days, you know, you could do painting, the set painting, you know, and I did some of those big things on that. And they were interesting, the size, you know, breaking up, and design as well. And I found I was quite competent at design, you know, in a way. So, which happened in the book a little bit, I think. Anybody agree with me?
Yes, well, book, while we have it, have we got the book in here? No, we don't have a book in here.
Yes, we do. There we are.
This book is a summary of Alan's work until now.
It's portraiture, that is. I've done a lot of other stuff.
Particularly based on the portraiture. Alison put it together, and And here is some intimation of the range of your portraiture, and a lot of the development of it, I feel that we now see, I feel it really started to take off after you got back from that long journey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it does in the book, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, yeah. And that it became more, comes more and more into definition through the 60s until it becomes very, very secure in itself during the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one on the cover is a mid-70s one, mid-70s, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's yeah. 77, I think. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a good interpretation. Yes, that's it. I mean, that was a concrete period of time.
Yeah.
There was one or two in 1970s, yeah, 76, no, 72 around there was one or two good ones as well, I think. Anyway, yes, but that, at the time it went right up to that period. I think they were pretty strong in the Huia period, you know, and that's when I took the other trip again, but that was then where the Italian works come about and then a few English ones as well.
Yes, you returned to Europe again in that period before you finally went to live in Italy, didn't you? There was another journey back where you went and you had an Arts Council scholarship and you went to look at galleries.
Later?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was, I'm just trying to remember the chronology, was that the early 70s when you made the journey around the galleries? On an Arts Council grant, and you had to write a report.
1976. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just thinking. That was 1976. In 1977 is when I wrote the for that journey. I wrote the for the Queen Elizabeth Arts Council. I wrote that report on the journey, which I thought was very good, actually. You know, it was a bit sort of hilarious and, you know, it had a bit of wit to it, etc. But I pulled things together. I pulled the whole history of art together. It was like a mini version of the history of art right through from what I was visiting all the way through from London to Paris to, you know, down to Spain, the Prado, the lot, you know, right round to Rome and up to Siena and all those places, and north and right through to Munich and all of them, put them together to end up in Cologne, you know, the galleries there. But it was actually a very good trip, and I wrote, a very good article. I still got, I think, you know, I did for myself, really. It was such a come-together of certainty, even literally. If you wanted to publish the book there, which McCann read and said it shouldn't be published.
What, the article?
Yeah.
Now, why do you think he said that?
I don't know. Went into the... In fact, the chap who was in charge of the Queen Elizabeth Arts Council at the time, I think it was Hamish Keith, actually, said I should publish it. It was the last time I had any words with Hamish Keith. And then the first half was published, but the stronger half was the second half. And the editor, with Alison as a witness, said that McCann had wrote in and said that they shouldn't publish the second half.
Do you think it might have been because... To hark back to what I said earlier about McCann's treatment of landscape, that he sent you approaching things from a completely different perspective.
Yeah, different spiritual world.
And
I was breaking the bounds of what he wanted this place to be and what they all wanted to be at the time, a new culture. What I was bringing him was a universal one. I don't know whether it is universal in the sense of my singularity because I'm part of the universe as well, but the... they were actually trying to create a new world here. And he became the guru. And he was fostered by people who needed place in society within the arts. And basically that's what they did. And they kept it and they charged it. And then it became, you know, black and I didn't mind some of his work, but, you know, his middle distances were memories of Van der Velden. Van der Velden's middle distances are similar, only not flattened out to such a degree. Because in the middle distance you get the feeling of mystery.
Mm.
And if you get a gradation of tone on a middle distance flat, it will do things to you. the creator, the mystery. You know, it's there. The light on the top, the shaft, God. The thing, the entombment, the land. The heads bowed to the altar. The land was the altar. And this became a big church for them. It became the great mysterious stuff. It re-anointed the place. It became a religion to them, a national religion.
Well,
not as bad as National Socialism.
but your paintings don't, throughout that period, late 60s, 70s, 80s, your paintings had land in them to quite a degree.
Okay.
But I think you were interpreting land another way.
Oh,
and
yes, totally.
At times, in the Huia time, when you're often at Huia and painting on painting forms based, I suppose, on the rainforest and the rhythms of that as universal
you're right.
rhythms.
Yeah.
You were giving it more. I felt that there were two things going on in that period. You could see that landscape was all powerful and could consume individuality, but at the same time, you could see that it was supremely musical at
That's
the
right.
same time.
You're right, right.
So
what I did was
there's an ambivalence
the
in it.
What, you know, there's one in the Christchurch Public Gallery, which is The Coming of Man and the Waimak, and the Waimakariri. And I remember looking at the Waimakariri, and I knew it needed, it was a stage. It needed entry. It needed splendor. It needed something to come out and start making it evolve, you know, in a visual sense, you know. I mean, it evolved to what it was, but it was missing something, and it was missing the best of what we were. I was still thinking that man could actually do something with it or create, you know, something greater. Or not greater, but enhance it.
Well, what do you think of the statement by William Blake, which might seem strange in the mouth of someone who's as much of an ecologist as me, but Blake said, where man is not, nature is barren.
No, that's all right. That's true.
Now, okay. I've often struggled to interpret that particular statement.
Yeah.
Because
I think
I can see why
yeah.
he's saying
but
that.
But there's a sequence. Something has to grow, and so it has to appear sometime, and it appeared at the particular time that it needed it. From my viewpoint, it's my state of consciousness. And that's what the world is, consciousness. That's what we are, acts of consciousness. If we don't use it properly, we don't build on it. That's all.
Well, perhaps you were... throughout those years, and here I'm talking quite broadly.
It's metaphysical consciousness.
Yeah.
It's a metaphysical consciousness. It isn't structures in the sense of material. You know, it's not lintel systems all over the place building little platforms for everybody to wave at each other. You know. Yeah. Sort of. Hello. How are you, Dennis? What have you done today? I built another building.
I'm pretty good. I've been talking to a chap called Alan Pearson.
That must have been a frontier nature.
Yeah, yeah. it's in your relationship with, I suppose, the natural world or the land of New Zealand that you were coming from a different phase of time. This is my opinion, of course. You were coming from a different phase of time to the time phase in which, let's say, Rita Angus and McCann might have been working. They were discovering it as people who had been born here and who were suddenly seeing what was out there. You were discovering it as somebody already charged with the dance of of the expressionist European tradition. And that put you in a different time.
Well, you could put it like and say, well, they were appearing for here. I appeared from everywhere to here, to some an aspect of it, you know, of everywhere to here, and they were concentrated on in a provincial way, really. But they had to have that period of time for them to expand after that. I realized it was a building process. I realized it was development. I realized that, you know, it was an evolvement, you know, part of evolutionary from any immigrant coming in, trying to give it credibility, coming up against Maoris and things like that, you know, and we're sort of a Pacific sort of mention against tribalism and sort of like that, and where you having to go back into tribalism to actually be part of the land as well, which they had. They were forced to in lots of ways to do it. So they retracted into tribalism to create a new culture, bound in a literal way with the Maori history too, or the Maori traditions. That gave them a new sense of country, but they lost where they came from. And that was the thing, what it is. They cut off thousands of years here for the sake of thinking that they were different. And it's actually, I think that was, a good effort. I'm not wrong, but if you come in whistling a song off the stage, a free spirit, then they, you know, here I am, yeah, you're not one of them, straight away. You know, and yet you're giving them something. You're not taking something away from them. And that was the greatest fear here. It wasn't that you were taking away. They just wanted you to fit in the best way you could for what they were, and they would give you the position. That's a class structure again. It's the building of class structure, just like it did in England in the past. Well, and now so they couldn't, and that's it. From McCann and all that, they started building it. I mean, the colour of black, the density of black, from Hawtrey and all them, is the black. Now, it is significant for the land, and it may be significant for the sound of the land, if you want to. There is a dark, primal thing about New Zealand, and that basically you can't help but take on a little bit of it, and appreciate it too. But they started making it into an altarpiece of difference, as though that they were different to the rest of the world, and went they were the culmination of preciousness.
Well, what about the musical aspect when you, which is very dominant in your paintings? You often strike me as wanting, whereas the mainstream of that period in New Zealand painting wanted to be earthed, you often strike me as wanting to float off into musical forms.
I don't think.
And
I see.
I'm just wondering if that, in some ways, influenced your decision.
Well, have you ever
decision,
heard music?
For
look,
instance,
reach for angelic circumstances.
Well, I see it in a lot of the painting.
Yeah, that's right. That's music. Music lifts. It doesn't start digging holes and burying yourself in. It's not earthbound to the degree. You need the earth only as a means of, like a rocket needs to take off. The earth is lovely, but it's a place. And you don't mistreat it. It is what it is. But when you start bowing your head and sticking your head in it, you do become an ostrich. You know?
Well, your flotation, your flotational impulse,
you know,
shall we say.
I'm a song and dance man. Somebody said, what are you? I said, I'm a song and dance man. That's
your musical impulse.
Yeah.
Do you think that lay behind the decision that caused you and Alison to move to Italy to try and live in an operatic culture, or culture with a very operatic history?
I did try to live in it that way, but then again, the people who live in it, they're a step forward in time from the period when it actually was at its apex. And they're mostly designers and things like round out and trendies and all sorts, just like every book at Alison. But they have a magnificent history. They've lived off it for years. I mean, for all the things they've done. I mean, so it's a marvellous thing. And it does have a musicality about it. If you enter from, you know, come out over the Alps and you go right through the centre down to Bologna and those places, and then south through there. But you can feel it singing all the way along. And you can go along with what you know about it. And you can go along with Bellini. You can go on with Verdi. You can go on with the thing. You can go on with the soul, like in Pagliacci Pagliacci, what was the other opera, the one-act opera? Anyway, the one with Pagliacci. But in it, and when I was down south, we lived in Matera in the south, which is in Basilicata, and that was a real struggle. You realise the 19th century and all the centuries before, until modernism came about to a degree, which, you know, it was a hell of a struggle. I could see it, you know, and some of the pain which is in the music, you know, and which comes through at times, is there. You can feel it in the soul. If you go at 12 o'clock at night with full moon and the earth has just been tilled, they get clumps about that big, just like big monumental clumps, all like that, casting shadows of all shapes, and depends what your mind does with them when you're looking at them. and then it lumps up the top with a little tree by itself. Nothing but moonlight, extreme darks and cast shadows, and then the night, just that blue, eternal night, you know, with the stars in it. And you, the loneliness is as nearly as much as going through to the Devil's Marbles in Australia, you know, just north of Alice Springs, which is another sense of being on a planet all alone, you know, at night. And so there's that. But you get a profound compassion for them, for the nature of what their struggle was and what they collectively struggled, farmers, you know, the peasants and all that. And all those stories, you know, and all the tales of how they murder each other with love, affection and all that stuff, you know, and the tragedy of it all, which comes out triumphal at the end by a great work of art. That's where we're saved, by the great work of art. It's not a social national dimension we're saved by. We're saved by the great compassion and the great awareness of where it all lays in the journey.
So it's in Matera in that time that I wonder if your concept for the theatre works fully consolidated. When you're already living
As you were talking before, it literalised it a bit, didn't it? It took you back in some sense of action for the period of time too. But if you notice in that exit from a cold theatre, or exit from a theatre of time, was basic as an earthquake. Yes. An earthquake had taken place. We were in it, 7.6, bigger than the one at Wellington, in Christchurch. And so the whole thing shambles. You can feel it. And everything comes down at the end. All the stones, all the houses, all the pain of the past, all the cries of centuries. You look at some of the hovels there and like that, and you look in the face of them, and you're looking into the skeletal frame of Italy for 1,000 years. You can go through from layer after layer and layer and watch the change where it comes, where they're living in caves at the side, building the first Christian altarpieces and the little mangers to the side. One after then they start crawling across each of the roofs, and then you get to the top of the escarpment and you've got a great big crane going for the lintels to come. You get what I mean? And so, but it's all struggle. But within it, they did some marvellous pieces of rendering their pain and joy and gave it reason. If they could do that, then it's well worth the fight. And that's what there should be in life, well worth the fight. Otherwise, it just matters for every day. And that's why we're all interested in cooking, because that's it, because nobody else can think of anything else for films, no?
Well, Myrie, I can't resist asking if you can possibly shoot this particular image. It's pretty big.
Turn it around.
Because this is the flight from the theatre of time.
It needs to be widened so you don't get that crease in the middle.
And to me, that is...
Tilt it forward slightly. I've got a wee bit of a light. There you. Okay.
Cool. That is...
I might get inside.
For want of a better term, it's a kind of world historical painting.
Yeah, you're right.
And it sums up the feelings of that period, I think, very dramatically.
Everything falls down at the end, you know? We're always clamouring to get it up, even relationships, you know what I mean? Sort of you're saying, well, you know, we must work on this to stay together. You know, I need a support. I need this and need that. So you've got to study it up and keep the moment. Why do people go back and try to keep the buildings? Because they have a moment which is beyond their moments they've had. They wouldn't even look after them if they thought that they'd done something better. Oh, but it is, or it becomes a gravestone to the past, you know, or, you know, a monumental thing, you know, other than a milepost. But then some of those places generate fear as well. Rome is a fearful place. I think I wrote it in that report I had, which McCann didn't like.
Now, from this period on, again, of course, I'm having to talk in generalities, but from this period on, you stay in Italy, you also stay in England for a period again, but then you return to New Zealand, and more you start to move in the direction of a...
Could I just stop 1 minute?
Okay.
Just a second. How long have we got?
Oh, shall I cut?
I don't want to leave it out.
Okay, off you go.
Well, after returning from that quite long stay in Italy and quite a long stay in London, and you and Alison are both back in New Zealand, your work becomes more focused on, for want of a better word, abstract painting. You're moving more towards paint as pure energy forms,
right.
dance forms, where the figure begins to become less individualised but more representative of a universal energy pattern.
In some ways, I find some of those things even further advanced than some of the portraits.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's not that period of time. But they're intricate, and I've done them purposely for the sake of the dance, of a symphonic movement, and of spontaneity as being. If you can, spontaneity is the purest sense of application, and it actually keeps the truest sense of what was being said, because nothing escapes, because it's done straight away. So you've got to be in the format of not changing, but moving. Right through, you're connecting, interconnecting, like that. It's just like a turmoil, but bring it out of chaos. Baroque, if you want to, in the moment, but it just is that, you know. So it's a sense and sounds, but I like the figures creating movement and countering each other, you know, for harmony, you know, all the way through. So you've got, if you look at some of those things, like even that one, there's sections in them. On the basis, like on the stage, the buildings and that are creating different movements right through. You get what I mean?
Yes.
And they connect up, you know, like that. So you're having to connect with the same tempestuous feeling you've got for the whole thing. So nothing is separate. There's no separate application, even though it looks different, because it's fundamental to the whole form. So what is one thing is only an aspect of the whole form. So everything goes together and everything is equal, but yet triumphant as a whole.
So
you know, in some ways, you know, I mean, I'd love to, I've got to say in a piece of music, you know, somewhere, you know, well, I'd like to, yeah, Beethoven, if you want to, you know, it's, you get some of his later things, you know. Some was piano music. What was it? The old great thing. The Eroica, or if you know, or the Seventh. I love the Seventh. I've loved the Seventh since I was a 7 year. Yeah, but you know, but the triumph. And everything's answering each other, talking to each other. See, all the time, just swing along. So it all forms out, becomes volume.
Well,
and if it's
that,
in the right content, if it's in the right mood, then it becomes a work of art.
I see that that kind of process emerging progressively in your painting.
Yeah, that's right.
In the years after Italy and the years that we recently moved through when you've been living in Australia and you've revisited the Australian bush of your youth.
Yeah.
And found the music in it, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe it's a bit, I have to do a bit more to that yet. I don't know, it's died off lately. I think it's the book. I've been working on the book for 6 months. Go on.
Nonetheless, you've maintained your central loyalty in to portraits, self-portraits, and strongly individualised presences as well.
Oh, don't forget,
throughout this period.
I quite love people for character, not for character, for personalities. You know, I mean, people like Judith in there, there's great natures in them. You know, you can feel them struggling or fighting, you know, and they're at certain levels of being, you know. Someone like Filigree just sitting there like this, you know, light in the air with the brain going like this, you know, sort of thing. Or or somebody solid, you know, sort of hard behind, and you know, but they say pain's there somewhere, and you sense just in the beings, it just is. Everybody is a stage. You can make a stage of it if you want to, and I think that's in some ways everybody has that thing, that pure thing of themselves, and I think that's the main thing they've got. A lot of things that's come through from the past, you can get gene structure. You get things, messages coming from 1,000 years ago. Fear comes from thousands of years ago, if you want to, also to pass it, or little things, you know, which escape in your time. We've come to full travel through time, and full, it's like an evolutionary thing, you know, of movement and feeling sometimes, and it enacts itself out in you. You become a stage for what has been enacted before, which was not freed.
Right.
You get it? Mm. And so it is enacted now, but you are pushing that on, but you're also letting free in that, but you're also pushing on something else into space where, so that it can be taken up to further the definition of the human condition, you know, or I would say sensitivities.
Well, this book records, as I've said, the process of your recording of psychic reality in people. Yeah. Would you like to say a few words about the book? Alison is the author of the book.
I would not dare say anything about it, and it
is a particular chronology. It doesn't take in all your paintings by any means, but it takes in a kind of central chronology which travels out from there into your big abstract landscapes, etc.
Also, I think it's more sort of readable to a bigger audience than it would be some other works I do, because basically other people have to be sensitive to that area more, you know, in the musical abstraction or figurative abstraction. But this, when it comes to the human, to the portraiture, it belongs to everybody more. They'll get a quick recognition whether they like it or not, or don't like it, or whatever it is, or it's rubbish and anything. It'll still hit them. It's still a symbol which is going to, they can't turn away from totally. Well, you know, they can for disliking or whatever it is, or liking. I don't know how you explain that. But the other stuff, you know, people go, what's that? And just walk out like that. Unless you say, God, that's it, you know? And it becomes more then. But even amongst this, it becomes more selective the older it gets, the book gets. Because basically it's more selective on the basis that it's becoming, I think, in some places, more profound in what I had to say. You know what I mean? Because I got to know myself more. So with that, I'm less leaning on others to profoundly say to what I am. I'm doing it for them more. I'm bringing them out. I'm not worried where I am, really. I'm just going through what I am, what I'm able to do. You know? Right? They say it, though, with the book. Just a sec. This book would never have come about without Alison. And she actually did a marvellous job. It would never have been enacted. She's had to go through everything on this because I'm useless on computers, all sorts of stuff. She wrote the text and that, you know, and it was marvellous. And she fitted it in as well with each painting. So it's, if you look at this book, it's very different to what it's generally done. It's something which is said for each painting, and also other people have brought into their interpretation of a sitting for me. And she knows well what that's like too. Also, she has a very good eye, and she did help in the arranging of the text with the paintings, the image. And so, you know, the whole thing. And she did all the struggle of, she's the editor. She's done a lot, you know, that's it. This wouldn't have come about. And we worked as a good pair. But this is her book.